This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Ron DeSantis is sworn in as Florida's 46th governor today. DeSantis won the election after a hard-fought race, but details of how he'll govern are only now taking shape. And as Florida Trend Associate Editor Jason Garcia writes in the latest edition of the magazine, DeSantis is a mystery to many Floridians. For more on what to expect from the new governor, Garcia joins us now. Welcome back to Intersection.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about what we can expect from Ron DeSantis. You write in the most recent edition of Florida Trend that as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, he was kind of to the right of a lot of his colleagues. Was he a Tea Party candidate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was about as far right as you could get. He was a member of what they call the Freedom Caucus in the House, which is the most ultra-right members of the House. And that's how he was elected. He was elected sort of in the Tea Party movement. Yeah, you don't get any more conservative in Congress than Ron DeSantis.
When you look at what we might expect from him as governor, can you kind of read into some of what he championed as a lawmaker up on Capitol Hill and say this is going to tell us how he's going to govern, or is it two completely different things?
It's not completely different. The partisanship is more intense in Washington. The issues are different. Although there is overlap, what you can probably read into his tenure in D.C., some of the stuff that you might see is, generally speaking, he was very dogmatic. He's very sort of conservative and predictable on most issues, but he would sort of show some flexibility when it would sort of suit his purposes. The classic example of that is, you know, he initially, like most of the Freedom Caucus, opposed Superstorm Sandy recovery money under the sort of the normal arguments you hear that it's just sort of the government can't afford this sort of thing. But as he was getting ready to run for governor, when this came up with Florida needing money after hurricanes Irma and Maria, he supported that. You know, he was sort of, there were some conservative members of Congress, even in Florida, that would still oppose it. He would not, because, you know, he was running for governor, and the last thing you want to be doing is opposing rebuilding money for Florida. So there is there's some evidence in his record that he isn't completely dogmatic when it comes to some of this stuff, but I think you can still read into it. You would expect him to be a very conservative governor.
And you could pretty much guarantee that at some point, at least in the next 4 years, he's going to be saying to Washington, we need some money for some kind of storm relief.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the big differences when you're in a federal office versus state office. The state office, he's going to be constantly looking for money from the feds. And obviously that was a big talking point in his campaign, that, you know, because of the relationship he has with Donald Trump, or the sort of the friendliness or the support he had from the president, that gives him an ally in the White House that makes him better suited to get money for Florida. But yeah, he'll be going hat in hand to Washington over and over for many things.
Mm-hmm. I know we're kind of looking ahead for this conversation, but I just wanted to get your assessment, Jason Garcia. How do you think he beat Adam Putnam?
Oh, that was entirely Donald Trump, right? In fact, Ron DeSantis' election was really interesting in that you know, for as intense as the campaign was, and I think ultimately all the candidates together spent well over $100 million, we actually know very little about Ron DeSantis, because in the primary, he ran as Donald Trump's candidate. It was the candidate Trump endorsed. If you'll remember, the most famous ad of that campaign was
build the wall.
Exactly.
His kids.
Yeah, right. And that was all about, I'm Donald Trump's candidate. So that's really all that mattered in the primary. So, I mean, that's how he beat Adam Putnam. You know, the president has an incredibly sort of feverish, devoted base within the Republican electorate. And once sort of Trump spread the word that this is the guy I want to win, DeSantis just sort of steamrolled Putnam.
Mm-hmm. If you look at what some of his priorities are going to be as governor, if you talk about somebody who, as you say, was pretty far to the right, part of the Freedom Caucus when he was in the U.S. House, how does that kind of mesh with a pretty broad and somewhat left-leaning goal of improving water quality?
Yeah, that'll be the most interesting thing to watch. And that was, you know, we mentioned earlier, there was sort of like a dearth of specifics about what Ron DeSantis wanted to do as governor. One of the few issues generally he hit very hard on was that he wanted to be an environmental governor. I think he repeatedly sort of labeled himself a Teddy Roosevelt Republican. It will be interesting to watch. Privately, a lot of people in Ron DeSantis' circle say that's where the biggest difference between he and Rick Scott will be, that you will see a much more sort of pro-environment policies and approach from Governor DeSantis. Where you're most likely to see that is when it comes to building a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. So not to get too far into the weeds, but you know, the discharges that everybody's that have been contributing to a lot of pollution in the St. Lucie and the Caloosahatchee rivers. One of the ways you theoretically solve that is you let water out of Lake Okeechobee south into reservoirs where it can be cleaned, and then also reestablish a flow down through the Everglades. Environmentalists have been convinced for years that the sugar industry has been blocking attempts to build a southern reservoir because they want to keep farming that land south of the lake. DeSantis, who has a very sort of confrontational relationship with the sugar industry, that's sort of one of the defining legacies of his term in Congress, has said very clearly he will push hard to get that done. So I think there'll be an assortment of environmental policies that come out, but the centerpiece of it all will be finding a way to accelerate the construction of a southern reservoir.
In some ways, some of the groundwork for that has been done in Tallahassee already, right? I mean, that was Joe Negron's project.
Yeah, that's right. But then there's been some issues there that, you know, the water management district in South Florida, right before the transition here, but sort of after Ron DeSantis' election, but before he took over, agreed to extend a lease to allow sugar companies continue farming some of that land that's needed for that. Ron DeSantis objected to that, although it still happened. I think another place where you will see a big difference with Ron DeSantis is the people he's appointing to the boards of these water management districts, particularly in South Florida, that you will see a much more environmental bent rather than an agricultural bent on the appointed people getting named to these boards.
Are environmentalists saying that too? I mean, they're expecting that. I know that he got the endorsement of the Everglades Trust. So, like, generally speaking, do you get the sense that environmentalists think that he will follow through on some of these things he said?
Now, there's a big split in the environmental community about that. The Everglades Trust endorsements of Ron DeSantis was probably the most surprising moment of the general election. And I talked to, for that story of Florida Trend, we talked to Kimberly Mitchell, the executive director there, and that came down entirely to Ron DeSantis's sort of hostility to the sugar industry. That was what that endorsement was entirely based on. The Everglades Trust is convinced he will do what needs to be done to get a southern reservoir built, which, as I said, sort of theoretically solves your problem, discharges through the rivers, and also reestablishes a freshwater flow to the Everglades. Other environmentalists sort of see Ron DeSantis as a conservative, business-backed Republican who will generally, you know, not support growth management laws, who will, you know, support economic development, construction rather than preservation. They're not sure what to expect out of him out of Amendment 1. You know, how much will he actually try to buy land for conservation, that sort of thing. So most environmental groups actually sided with Andrew Gillum in the general election. That said, I think environmentalists are generally more optimistic about Ron DeSantis than they were about Rick Scott. Ron DeSantis has certainly talked a lot about water quality and wanting to make that a legacy issue. So there is some optimism there, but there's by no means are all environmentalists sort of enthusiastic about his administration.
And I guess the reality of governing might temper some of his more extreme urges in terms of wanting to sort of stick to what he said he's going to do versus the reality of being actually up in Tallahassee.
Yeah, that's right. You'll run into a couple of things. First, you don't have all the power in the world. You can't do everything you want, you know, and the truth is a lot of the money for this is going to have to come out of Washington for some of this stuff. And then you're dealing with the legislature. Now, the legislature is very Republican. The House is about as conservative as it gets. The Senate's more moderate. So you've got to sort of navigate things through that. So, yeah, the reality is whatever he's sort of envisioning doing, it won't look exactly the same by the time it gets done.
So you wrote in the article for Florida Trend, some of the people who are worried or may be worried about this incoming governor are sugar growers, but also hospitals.
Yeah.
Unpack that a little, if you could.
Yeah. So one of the most important moments in the primary election came when a guy in Tallahassee by the name of Jose Oliva, he's the new Speaker of the House. At the time, he was sort of scheduled to become Speaker of the House. He and Ron DeSantis met for coffee, just so it was supposed to be a meet and greet, and they ended up spending about an hour. It was actually at a coffee shop in Orlando. And Jose Oliva ended up endorsing Ron DeSantis in the primary. And this was well before it was clear that he was going to beat Adam Putnam. In fact, most people thought Adam Putnam was going to win at that time. So that was a big moment. And Speaker Oliva was by far the most powerful politician, Republican politician, to take DeSantis' side in the primary. And what that came down to almost solely was the fact that they both bonded over a belief that hospitals have sort of a regulatory monopoly, or have established regulatory monopolies, and that a big driver of healthcare costs is the fact that there's not enough competition among hospitals. Mm-hmm. So where one thing I think you will see a big priority for the DeSantis administration, and I know it will be a priority for Speaker Oliva in the Florida House, is eliminating the process by which hospitals have to apply for state approval to build new hospitals.
This is what's known as certificates of need.
That's right, exactly. Jose Oliva and Ron DeSantis would very much like to do away with that process entirely. And just if a hospital wants to build a hospital, they go ahead and do that. There are more areas where Ron DeSantis has talked about policies that hospitals generally like. A lot of it is pricing transparency. This is something mm-hmm. that began under Governor Scott, exactly, trying to compel hospitals to post prices of their procedures in a way that allows consumers to shop around for, you know, if you need, you know, some sort of inpatient procedure, or you can look at, you know, the five or six hospitals in your region and decide where you want to go based on price, theoretically.
What does that mean for hospitals in Central Florida? Because there's a lot of nonprofits here. Are they a little bit nervous about this?
Oh, I think hospitals generally are very nervous. You know, the argument you get from the hospitals a lot of times when it comes to like things like certificate of need is that healthcare is sort of counterintuitive in that, you know, more competition actually drives up costs. You know, they say mm-hmm. it forces them to compete for doctors and compete for facility or for equipment and stuff like that. That ends up raising prices rather than lowering them. So
that's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, the Jose Olivas of the world flat out don't believe that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're very nervous about this stuff. And then when you get into the pricing transparency and stuff, that the hospitals generally oppose that stuff. They say it's not nearly as simple as to post prices. And then you get into sort of the different confidential rates they negotiate with insurers. They don't want to disclose that for competitive reasons. But yeah, they're very nervous.
Another thing that's happened is that he's picked Mary Mayhew to run the state healthcare agency. She's the former top Medicaid administrator for the Federal Agency for Healthcare Administration. What does this kind of signal about the way healthcare might be managed in Florida?
Well, you know, she has a reputation for being primarily focused on cost cutting, on the cost side of the equation. I think it probably signals, along with the certificate of need stuff and the pricing transparency, that the DeSantis administration's primary focus to healthcare will be finding ways to reduce costs. I don't think there's any chance that there will be like a Medicaid expansion or anything. It won't be about expanding benefits or spending more money. It will be entirely about trying to find ways to reduce costs.
Do you think that's another thing that the DeSantis administration might run into some issues with down the track?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest obstacles to some of this is going to be the Florida Senate, which has sort of traditionally been a lot more sort of supportive of hospitals and in recent years sort of has pushed really hard to try and expand Medicaid. I would be shocked if that happens under Ron DeSantis' administration. You never say never. I mean, Rick Scott, sort of the one thing he was known for was opposing Medicaid expansion until he suddenly supported it when he was running for re-election and then opposed it again. So you never say never to this stuff. I've seen no evidence or no indication whatsoever that this is something even remotely on the drawing board. It would not happen under Jose Oliva. So for the next 2 years, that's not going through the House, at mm-hmm. least. I wouldn't expect it to happen. And then you've got a new U.S. Supreme Court. So who knows 3, 4, 5 years from now what this landscape even looks like at that point.
Indeed. What about economic development? What are we sort of reading into what might happen here under a DeSantis administration?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because he's sort of provided no specifics whatsoever, but just sort of generally said he wants to support, you know, continue Rick Scott's sort of economic agenda, which was basically tax cuts, deregulation, incentives, and then conservative courts, you know, courts that sort of make it harder for plaintiffs to sue businesses. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, Ron DeSantis was a Freedom Caucus Republican in the House, which is generally sort of very anti-incentive. This is one thing we asked him about in our story. And he made it sound like he is not dogmatically opposed to incentives, sort of the way you might have expected based on his congressional tenure. I think you will probably see somewhat less use of incentives through things like Enterprise Florida. I think Enterprise Florida he seems to view as more of like a cheerleading or marketing agency for the state. But he was very clear that he expects to continue using this new fund they set up a couple of years ago called the Job Growth Grant Fund, which gives out infrastructure grants to communities, which are, you know, economic development plays. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some incentives that come out of the administration still. And this is another thing. Once you're governor, you tend to want to use incentives because you get to show up at all the ribbon cuttings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, I think we don't know a ton of what to expect specifically. The other policy that seems to be percolating right now is he seems to be pretty set on continuing to reduce the sales tax on commercial rent. And that's been a big priority for the business lobby generally, realtors specifically, for a number of years. The legislature and Rick Scott trimmed it a little bit over the last year. The problem is it's a huge revenue generator, so it's hard to take a big bite out of it without devastating the state's finances. But that's, I would expect you'd see him pushing like another half cent or continuing to sort of chip away at that.
Speaking of things that take a big part of the Florida budget or a big proportion of the Florida budget, education is obviously colossally expensive in the state of Florida. And we've already seen some of what we can expect from him with the appointment of Richard Corcoran as the Commissioner of Education. So, and you wrote in Florida Trend that people who are fans of school choice have something to cheer about there.
Right.
What else are we looking for education-wise from this governor?
Well, I think vouchers will be expanded. That's something that's clearly a priority to him. He said that before, and then by appointing, you know, Richard Corcoran as Commissioner of Education, school choice will be a huge priority for that administration. Ron DeSantis has talked a lot about basically educational savings accounts, where it's just a set amount of money that a parent gets to use towards their student's education, or however they choose to do. Even if they homeschool, they get the money; they can use the use the money towards their child's education. Sort of completely decoupling funding from the public school system, and just making that just another sort of choice parents have. The other place that that he feels very strongly about, and yet you'll see a lot of legislation coming out of this this area, is career education. He seems to feel very strongly that that the education system has swung too much in the direction of, you know, steering every kid into a 4-year college degree without really prioritizing, you know, career skills. And one of the things, this was actually something Jeanette Nunez, his lieutenant governor, talked about, is as they were traveling around the state, they kept hearing from businesses that, you know, could not find the kind of workers they needed, you know, the specialized skills, welders, you know, air conditioning mechanics, these sorts of things. And this was something they heard over and over and over again, that there was workforce shortages, that they had all these jobs they could not fill. Ron DeSantis has talked a lot about trying to sort of get high schools, especially emphasizing career education more, tweaking the state's funding formulas, you know, or your grading formulas, where you reward schools with extra funding, mm-hmm. to sort of more encourage programs that lead kids to certificates or industry trainings or that sort of thing. And then you'll see some of this theoretically also meaning potentially more resources for the state colleges as well.
I imagine the universities might be a little bit concerned about that trend.
Yeah, I think it's not that they would normally – that they would have anything to – they would have any objections to this sort of thing, but there's, you know, a finite amount of money, right? And so it's got to come from somewhere. And I wouldn't expect Ron DeSantis to be pushing big university funding increases over the next few years. I think a lot of that money is probably more likely to go in the direction of career training.
Mm-hmm. Dana Young is the new head of Visit Florida. What do you know about her?
Well, she's a former legislator. She was in the House, where she was the House Majority Leader under, under Richard Corcoran for the first couple of years. And then she ran for Senate. You know, that was a really tight race. She's sort of well-regarded in Tallahassee. I have no idea what her background is as a destination marketer, but she's, you know, she's got a reputation for being sharp and well-liked and stuff. And, you know, for an agency like Visit Florida, which especially the last couple of years was under the gun with Richard Corcoran.
Yes, had some issues.
Right, right. Having someone who's sort of well-liked by the legislature, that might be a good thing for them.
Well, Jason Garcia is Associate Editor of Florida Trend Magazine. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Still to come, former felons head to supervisors of elections offices across the state to register to vote as Amendment 4 takes effect. So what's next for about 1.5 million newly eligible Florida voters? More on that when Intersection returns. This This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This morning, former felons, or returning citizens as they prefer to be called, are registering to vote at supervisors of elections offices all across Florida. That's as a new constitutional amendment takes effect, restoring the right to vote for about 1.5 million felons who've completed their sentences. It's a watershed moment for advocates for voting rights who wrote Amendment 4 to be as straightforward as possible. But what happens next may not be so straightforward. Well, Danny Rivero is a reporter with WLRN in Miami. He's been covering Amendment 4. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Danny, today is the day when folks who support this amendment find out what happens next. Theoretically, people who are former felons who've served their time can go to register to vote. What actually happens? What's your understanding of what happens from here on out?
So as far as we can tell, what's going to happen is that starting today, supervisors of elections in different counties are going to be able to start getting these applications into their hands. And not much actually is going to change at the county level. The questions about where things are going to stand is really at the state level, because the local supervisors of elections are then going to take those applications and send them up to the state. And there's a handful of state entities that actually have a hand in this. And, you know, Governor Rick Scott, his administration on the way out, they've taken the stance in federal court documents, because they have an ongoing lawsuit about this, that Amendment 4 goes into effect on January 8th. And, you know, our new governor, Ron DeSantis, he has taken the stance that this can't possibly go into effect until he has some kind of legislation. So in the meantime, nobody really knows what is going to happen, how these different state agencies, that's like, you know, the Department of Corrections, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the Department of State, nobody really knows how they're going to interpret this stuff once they start getting them in their hands.
Walk us back for a moment, if you could, Danny Rivero, because the folks who've been supporting this amendment have been trying to push it through and worked pretty hard on it for, you know, more than a year to get it in the books. They were quite adamant to say this was written in a way that it doesn't really need the input of any lawmakers. It's self-executing. So how is that not the case?
So they and I have talked to some lawmakers that say that this is self-executing. Even State Senator Dennis Baxley, the Republican who chairs the Ethics and Commissions Committee in the Florida Senate, he's talking about possibly implementing legislation with this. But he's told me, you know, I think largely this is self-executing. But the problem that state lawmakers are facing is the potential that, you know, you might have counties interpreting things in a different way, meaning, you know, in Miami-Dade, they might interpret it one way, and in Orange County, you might interpret it one way, so on and so on. So they're looking at it maybe down the line that they might need to offer some clarifications. But also in the short term, if one county, you know, interprets it in a more restrictive way, that could mean, you know, people potentially not being able to vote who should be able to vote. So you can see how that could easily lead to some court challenges and more confusion, actually.
Okay, so January 8th is the day when supposedly everything kicks off, but do we have to wait a little while before some of these other agencies can take a look at things and actually make sure that everything sort of rolls out the way it should? And do we have to wait until legislative session before folks might actually be able to vote, people who've served their sentence and aren't violent offenders or sex offenders per the constitutional amendment?
I think the answer to that is kind of complicated, because I don't know if we have to wait. We might end up waiting, but that's only because there's some municipal elections that are starting as early as kind of mid-February. So if you were to actually register today on January 8th, you'd be able to vote in some of those. Now, voting applications take a couple weeks to register. So within a couple weeks' time, if people that register don't get those back and the state comes to them and they say, hey, you know, we haven't been able to verify that you got your rights restored, then that's where you're going to start seeing challenges. But it's possible that that's not going to happen. I mean, we just don't really know, because there's been basically zero communication with the public, or as far as I can tell through my reporting, from state agency to state agency. And of course, we're also, you know, changing governments at the state level now. So there's a lot of turnover going on. So we might have to wait. But I don't know if legally that's what should be happening if it does happen.
What have you heard from incoming Governor Ron DeSantis about this?
Well, the Ron DeSantis' stance is that, you know, this needs to get legislated. Some things need to be more clearly defined, according to him, before this goes into effect. So even though on paper it says January 8th, his stance is basically, okay, it says January 8th, but we can't actually really pull the trigger on it until I get some kind of, you know, clarification on what does it mean that someone's completed their sentence. Does that mean they've paid all their court costs and fines? I mean, that's going to be a very big question, because some particular felony charges come with very big fines and costs, and those aren't, you know, always easy to pay off. Some of them are up in the six figures. So you might have a lot of people that, if they owe six figures, that's a very hard debt to pay off, and those people wouldn't be able to vote. Or if they decide you don't have to pay all your fines before you get your rights restored, then you can vote.
Yeah, it does sound kind of complicated. Is it partly because sometimes there isn't great communication between agencies too? I mean, if somebody's trying to find out from one agency, you know, where somebody fits within that system, if they've gone through the criminal justice system and they're not getting that information, is that going to make things tricky as well?
Yeah, I mean, reporting this story just really, really has shown me, you know, there's a, I don't know if they call it a lack of communication, but there's just complication. There's a complexity of communication that's really difficult, because I mean, from the clerk of court, you know, that every county has, there's 67 of them in the state of Florida, to the Office of Offender Review and the Department of Corrections, and you know, there's so many different entities that have different people heading them, and they all have some small hand in this. And you know, according to the activists, and you know, I've talked to some people that actually helped draft this, they said, look, according to the Constitution, at this point, you have a right to vote. If you're registering, you have a right to vote, and it's completely up to the state to figure all that out. I don't know if it's not, you know, being naive on their side, but they're basically saying the state needs to just do its job. And while we're in between kind of administrations, that's proving to be a lot easier said than done.
Danny Rivero, I guess kind of stepping away from the bureaucracy for a moment, the bureaucratic entanglements, do you get the sense still, though, from the folks you've talked to who are excited about going and registering to vote, that this January 8th still is a big deal and a big day for them?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's something that, you know, some people have waited decades for. You know, if you have a felony charge, say from the 70s or the 80s, I mean, some people haven't been able to vote for anyone since Jimmy Carter. You know, overnight, this stands to really transform the electorate. I've talked to people that are very excited, you know, veterans who haven't been able to vote for decades because of something stupid they did. And they're saying, you know, I'm going to go on the day of, and I'm going to go register to vote because I'm an American. And then now we have this amendment, and then I'm going to go do it. You know, it's a cause for celebration. And across the state, there's a couple nonprofit groups that are organizing, you know, kind of get out the vote, but it's not, yeah, get out the registration really is what they're doing. And I anticipate that we're going to see more of that in the coming months. I mean, whether this ends up being challenged in court, if it doesn't roll out really smoothly or not, you know, I think there's a lot of, This has been pent up for so long for so many people, and the process to actually get your rights restored, as it was with the clemency board, was so difficult, and it, you know, it's just a hard drive. People had to go to Tallahassee. It's far from a lot of the population centers, so you know, just making it simple, making it easy, it has a lot of people very excited.
Danny Rivero, speaking of the clemency board, what sort of role do they have from here on out? Is it going to be as big and important as what they've had up until now?
You know, that's a good question, because the Governor Rick Scott, his administration, they had a lawsuit about it. They lost part of it, and they've basically argued that it's moot now because they consider, you know, Amendment 4 goes into effect as it should on January 8th. But it's also important to recognize that there's other rights that are not included in Amendment 4. Like, there's different licenses you can get for different occupations. If you want to be you know, a nurse, or if you want to be an attorney, you know, those are things that are also limited when you have a felony conviction. You know, if you want to serve on a jury, And the clemency process includes those. Amendment 4 is actually specifically only to the right to vote, but there's still a lot of rights that you miss if you do get a felony conviction. From what I know, it seems like the clemency process will be to restore some of those other rights because those were not included.
And it sounds, too, as though the folks who've been pushing for Amendment 4 will also have some more work on their hands if they want to get those rights restored for former felons as well. I'm wondering, too, I mean, Florida isn't the only state where they've sort of faced this kind of crossroads, if you will, or come to a point where former felons' rights to vote are being restored. So should Florida be looking to other states to see how they've gone about getting this process done?
You know, Florida is kind of an outlier because as other states have done this, but they haven't done it in this kind of way with a popular referendum. The biggest similar case was Virginia a couple years ago, and that was from an order from the governor who had, you know, all the reins of the executive power at his control. So they rolled it out. They did it as they saw fit. I mean, nobody has done this with a ballot item. At least not on the scale that we're seeing. I mean, this is, you know, you're talking about over a million people that are going to, on paper, gain the right to vote. So it really kind of isn't in its own kind of realm. We're kind of in uncharted territory a little bit here.
Where are you going to be, Danny Rivera? Are you going to be watching as some of those folks sign up to register to vote?
Yeah, I'm actually going to be spending some time with a couple veterans who have waited a long time to be able to register, and I'm going to meet up with them, and they're leaving their jobs in the middle of the day because they say, "Hey, we're so excited, we're going to take a couple hours out of our workday, and we're going to go down there, and we're going to register." You know, finally, you know, and maybe that speaks back to what we were just talking about enhancing other people's other rights, like the right to serve on a jury. The reason that getting the right to vote is so important because politicians pay attention to people who vote. If you don't vote, there's little incentive for politicians to pay attention. So if all of a sudden a lot of people with felony convictions can vote and have a say in whether you get that job or not, you know, maybe they'll start paying attention to these other concerns.
Well, Danny Rivero is a reporter with WLRN in Miami. He's been following the story about Amendment 4. Thank you so much for your time, Danny.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, the StoryCorps mobile recording booth is parked up at the Orlando Museum of Art. We talked to site manager Jacqueline Van Meter about what happens when you record a conversation inside StoryCorps' Airstream trailer. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Friday mornings on NPR are synonymous with StoryCorps, the three-minute conversations you hear, intimate, moving vignettes from all over the country and people from all walks of life, are distilled from longer conversations that are recorded and archived at the Library of Congress. For the next month, StoryCorps' mobile recording booth, housed inside an Airstream trailer, will be parked at the Orlando Museum of Art to record conversations from the Central Florida community. Mobile site manager Jacqueline Van Meter says at its heart, the StoryCorps mission is one of public service, allowing people to record an intentional conversation documenting whatever they want. And what began as a booth in Grand Central Terminal in New York City in 2003 has been transported all over the country.
So way back in the day, the initial format was there was a booth set up in Grand Central Station in New York. And that was kind of a pilot project. A guy named Dave Isay, our founder, put together the idea, got some support for it, and created this booth in Grand Central. And lo and behold, people started to really engage with the idea of taking time out of their day to sit down and record. And so the idea was if we could make the experience something accessible in a place like Grand Central Station, and of course, when people record with StoryCorps, they're given the opportunity to have the recording archived at the Library of Congress. We thought, what better way to create sort of an oral history of the United States than to bring the recording booth to the rest of the United States? And so that's kind of how the idea of the mobile booth began.
How long has it been part of public radio?
So really from the early days, from the inception, because Dave Isay, our founder, has a background in public radio. And so I think the notion was not only to give people the opportunity to record and to archive, but then to start to share those stories on the airwaves for other people to sort of, you know, learn from the wisdom, the humor, the love, the pain that people express in their conversations. And so from basically its inception, we've been fortunate enough to partner with NPR to have excerpts from these incredible conversations aired nationally.
Mm-hmm. What does it actually mean to have your conversation archived in the Library of Congress? Like, is there a physical place that a tape gets stored, or how does that actually work?
I know, it's kind of amazing, right? So we, you know, we conduct the recordings on site in the booth. We have an archive team at StoryCorps that works closely with the Folklife Center, the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. And so after a rigorous processing procedure that our archive team takes care of in Brooklyn, New York, in our headquarters, the files are then transferred to the team at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. And so digital copies are stored there, but they're available to the public. Any member of the public can enter the Library of Congress, ask to access the StoryCorps collection, and with the assistance of an archivist, people can conduct a search. And then they're given a copy of the recording that they can listen to on site.
So they have like listening booths or something?
They do, yeah. They have a little booth set up with a CD player and some headphones where you can sit and listen.
Do people go do that?
People go and do that, believe it or not. I mean, we're always on the move, right? And so we joke that sometimes this idea of the Library of Congress is something we talk about every day, but we don't physically interact with it, even though it's such a fundamental part of our work. But a colleague who was on the mobile team right when she completed her one-year term as a facilitator on the mobile tour, went to visit the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. and talked to an archivist and asked them. And turns out that fairly frequently people come in and are really interested in finding stories from their community or in particularly from family members.
So, I mean, StoryCorps has been running for a number of years now. There must be thousands of stories in that archive.
That's right. The project began in 2003. Mm-hmm. To date, we're pushing 77,000 interviews that have been recorded through kind of traditional recording booths like the mobile booth. We also have some permanent kind of brick and mortar recording operations, one in Chicago and another in Atlanta. But then in addition to that, we actually debuted a StoryCorps mobile app a couple of years ago after getting some money from winning the TED Prize, put that towards building an app. And so anybody who has a smartphone can download for free a copy of the app. And since that debuted in 2015, we've already had an additional 155,000 recordings that have come in through people recording on their own. Mm-hmm. So clearly people are really excited about the idea of having their recordings preserved and archived for posterity.
Given the amount of interest there is in this tour stop, and I'm sure every place you go, every city you go to or town you go to in the United States, There's a lot of interest in StoryCorps. I wonder if you could just kind of walk us through the process. Like, if you are able to snag one of those appointments and you can actually go to the recording booth and record your story, what actually happens?
Great question. So end-to-end, the entire experience for participants is about an hour. Before we arrive in town, we open up some appointments on the appointment calendar, and so you have to book in advance, of course, because depending on the community, there is a lot of interest. If you make an appointment, we're open 5 days a week, starting at 10:30 a.m. You come in with a partner, someone from your life that you'd like to interview or be interviewed by, and you're greeted by a StoryCorps facilitator, either myself or someone from my team, and they give you a little orientation on what to expect, fill out a little bit of information. Once everyone feels prepared and ready to go, we always ask participants, you know, what are you looking to get out of your conversation today? So we can help along if needed, make sure everyone's on the same page. They enter the booth. We have a little recording space on one side of the Airstream where we close those doors and enter the soundproof area. The two folks will sit down at a table. We've got microphones set up. They have up to 40 minutes to record a conversation. Of course, they don't have to use all that time, but it's theirs for the taking if they want it. Really, what people choose to do with that time is very much open to them. But they've got 40 minutes. At the end of the 40 minutes, then there are a couple of other procedural things we do. We talk about whether or not the participants are interested in archiving the conversation they've just recorded. And, you know, there's some considerations there. So we talk through that.
So they don't have to archive it?
No, definitely not. They could do Library of Congress only. They also have the option, if they're feeling inclined towards something more public, to give us permission to both archive it at the Library of Congress and then share it with, you know, our public radio partners so it could be aired, you know, or considered for airing on NPR. But certainly there's no obligation whatsoever. If the participants don't feel like they're ready to share at that time, they can simply take a copy themselves and it's for them.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to Jacqueline Van Meter. She's the site manager for StoryCorps' mobile tour, which is in Orlando for the next 5 weeks. Jacqueline, sometimes people get a bit intimidated by having a microphone in front of them. So is some of that time they have to get this story out as involved in just sort of getting them comfortable in front of the mic and comfortable with the idea of recording the conversation?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a great question. And different people come in with different attitudes about it, and it can be intimidating. And really, our goal as facilitators is to try to demystify the process and make everyone feel really, really comfortable. And we've also, if you'll join us in the mobile booth, we've created an environment there that's really focused on intimacy. The lights are low, wooden paneling, it's nice and quiet. And oftentimes, those microphones tend to disappear after a while and people settle in. But, you know, we walk people through, you know, kind of getting set up. We do a sound check, make sure that people feel comfortable. And yeah, after a minute or two, the jitters tend to go away and people really, really go places that oftentimes they don't expect.
Speaking of distilling that conversation down, I mean, how do you do that? Because that must be a challenging thing too. If you have like 40 minutes of tape from a couple of people, how do you figure out which bits to cut, what to leave in?
Right. Yeah, it's a challenge. You know, and I always start by reminding everyone that we record thousands upon thousands of conversations each year, and only a very small portion, unfortunately, are able to be shared. Although we're always looking at other ways that we can try to share that content. But, you know, I think that what ends up becoming a story, we think about it in a number of ways. One is, what are experiences or voices, perspectives on life in the United States that we haven't heard enough, that we need to be hearing more about? What are things that sort of the general public hasn't considered? How can we look at things from another angle? Mm-hmm. And so representation is really important to us. And additionally, thinking about, okay, if the national conversation is focused around an issue, how can, you know, are there stories that we've recorded or experiences that people have shared that could provide a lens onto this topic? And then, of course, from there, you've got 40 minutes. How can you distill it down? We try to look for moments that, you know, if we're smiling or if we're moved as facilitators listening in the booth, you kind of know right away this is going to move other listeners too. But then additionally, you know, it's just how do you tell a good story? Is there a beginning, a middle, an end? Does this create kind of a cohesive idea? Does this edited clip really give what we think of as a nice, vivid, representative insight into who this person is and what they're trying to say? Mm-hmm. And if you can capture that in 3 minutes, and it's tough to do, but if you can do it, then that's the hope.
It's a bit of an emotional roller coaster. Those little vignettes, you can go from kind of laughter to tears in the space of a minute or so. Mm-hmm. I mean, listening to all of that, that must be exhausting.
It's intense, yeah. And, you know, we're doing it 5 days a week. There's 7 interviews, you know, almost every one of those work days. It's very emotional work. But it's also unlike any other work you can do. I mean, I often think to myself, you know, only in the context of this job would I ever be, you know, witnessing this conversation. These people have just met me and they're willing to have a really intimate dialogue. And oftentimes the conversations themselves will run the gamut, you know, minute 5, they're laughing, and minute 7, it's something really poignant and emotional. And it's funny, the environment that we create in the booth really does prompt people to just be genuine. You know, they're stepping away from sarcasm, they're stepping away from the distractions, and they're just being really authentic with one another. And it is a ride, but it's so gratifying to be able to sort of create that space. It's as simple as saying, okay, you two, talk, no one's going to interrupt, I'll be recording it, and yet the sum is so much greater than the parts.
How important do you think it is, like, right now? Because we are in an era when so much of what you hear and see in the media is pretty challenging stuff. It's quite polarizing. And as you say, you're trying to get people to be genuine and sort of leave aside the facade, the sarcasm, whatever it is. So how important is the mission of StoryCorps right now, do you think?
I think it's more relevant than ever. You know, I mean, it's always meaningful to provide people the opportunity to have these intentional exchanges. But given that we are polarized, and we've discovered the power that storytelling can have to connect one another to our humanity, I think StoryCorps provides a really exciting opportunity for people to be surprised and to have their assumptions be unpacked and challenged and turned around just by hearing something that they completely relate to from someone that they never thought they had anything in common with.
Mm-hmm.
That's the exciting part of the opportunity that StoryCorps is working with right now. And we've heard time and time again, you know, these stories, they resonate with people. They are emotional. And it's because you can't sort of disregard someone's personal, emotional, lived experience. And even if it's something very different than yours, you know, and deep down, we're all sort of struggling with the same fundamental questions. And to hear that from, you know, voices and accents and parts of the country that you don't expect is crucial.
And there have been some episodes where you have actually brought people together deliberately from very different spectrums of the community to say, sit down and talk it out.
Yeah, that's right. This is sort of a new initiative that we've been working on over the last couple of years. It's kind of debuted last year, called One Small Step. And it's a specific project in which we are trying to bring together two individuals to sit down who kind of think of themselves as being from opposite sides of a political divide, one or another. And it's sort of taken different forms. I mean, I think we experimented initially with bringing together people who have a relationship but try to avoid politics because it's such a tense, you know, topic to discuss, especially these days.
It's kind of like a miniature version of the Thanksgiving conversation
exactly,
or something.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the original notion was, we have seen time and time again how just the setting of the booth, the idea of having this conversation be archived at the Library of Congress sets a different tone for people in terms of the intention that they bring into the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And the hope was that that format, right, and that sort of paradigm might work to help ease the tension and allow people who so often can just assign a bunch of assumptions to a person just because they think you are liberal, you are conservative, that environment, that setup could sort of diffuse that tension and allow people to just plug into one another's humanity and understand each other a little better. And so from there, we've started to experiment with bringing together people who don't know each other, which is a first for StoryCorps, to have them dialogue and see if, again, that sort of humanity activating scenario could help people to have these otherwise pretty difficult conversations. And
mm-hmm.
It's a work in progress, but so far, so good.
Jacqueline Van Meter, out of all of the conversations you've heard, are there some that really stick in your memory and stay with you?
Oh, there's so many. There's so, so many. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, the mobile tour is wild because you immerse yourself into a community for 5 weeks and you spend the first week or two just getting your bearings and understanding who you are in the context and who everyone is around you. And the beautiful thing about it is, you know, by, you know, week two, week three, you experience these recurring themes and you start to really get a sense of what matters to people in a place. And that's been what's interesting for me is, you know, for example, I started my journey in Colorado and there's just such a flavor to the way that people live life in Fort Collins. And we followed it up with being in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And so it was just a summer for me of hearing people talk about the relationship to the outdoors, which was just blew my mind. You know, the connection that people have to the land because it's just so spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And then going to a place like Bismarck, North Dakota, where there's a really interesting regional culture there that I wasn't really familiar with. There's a lot of modesty there and more reticence to actually kind of take the microphone and tell your story and a deeply entrenched sense of humility. So for me, I think although there have been just extraordinary conversations and memorable people, you know, 100-year-old World War II veterans or, you know, elderly folks bringing their harmonica in, you know, what has stood out to me as I look back over my experience as site manager on the mobile tour is just what a rich, delicious flavor of each community that you get after, you know, the experiencing, you know, a sum of so many interviews in a community.
Mm-hmm.
And really seeing what makes the heart beat in that community.
Jacqueline Van Meter, site manager for the StoryCorps Mobile Tour, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Matthew. Thanks for having me.
For more information about StoryCorps Stop in Orlando, including how to sign up for the wait list to record a conversation, and the listener event on January 31st, go to our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.